You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, if you live in the southern part of the U.S., you may know a lot of people with October or November birthdays. But if you live in the north, June and July might be the big birthday months. We'll find out why coming up.
Today marks the fifth day of the latest government shutdown. At issue is the president's demand from Congress that it pass a spending bill that includes $5 billion to fund the construction of a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The White House says the shutdown could last into the new year as both the president and the congressional Democrats dig in their heels. Our next guest is here to talk about the political and human ramifications as the shutdown continues.
Christine Emba is a columnist and editor for The Washington Post. Christine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time with us. Let's, first of all, set the scene a little bit. Here's President Trump speaking to U.S. military members on Christmas Day.
Just remember, the people in our country, we're very proud of you. The country's doing well. We have a little bit of a shutdown because we believe in walls and we believe in borders and we believe in barriers. And, you know, we have a special country. People have to come in through the legal process, not just walk in. We have no idea who they are. And we're stopping drugs at a record rate, but we need some help, and the help is the wall. We need a wall to help us.
That is President Trump again speaking to military members yesterday. Now, the president is very focused on getting this wall built. It's something that he campaigned on. It's something he hasn't dropped, despite Congress not providing the funding needed to build it, both with a Republican majority Congress and now heading into a congressional session that's split. Why is this still crucial to the president's platform?
Well, it's crucial to the president's platform because it's the defining plank of his platform. I mean, building a wall has become synonymous with Donald Trump, his campaign, and his presidency. It's seemingly the one promise that he made to his base and his voters. And as his popularity has continued to wane, as basically no other accomplishments have gone through in this first 2 years of his administration, building the wall is still the one promise that he can lean on and offer to the small coalition of people who are still supporting him, his base.
Well, speaking of which, you talked about the overall polls of the president dropping, but what have the polls said about this particular topic?
I mean, the polls are mixed. Again, on the Republican Party side, his base, that kind of core 30 to 40% of supporters who are still supporting him, yes, really want this wall. One of the reasons that Trump has pushed so strongly for the wall in recent days, actually, is because when he did sort of hint at compromising with Democrats, there was a huge outcry from far-right and conservative public figures like Ann Coulter, who represent the base and who basically said that they would abandon him if he didn't keep this promise. But I think that most of America, most workers, especially those who might be affected by this government shutdown as it continues to go on, would rather be paid, would rather have their jobs, would rather have the economy feel a bit more stable than to invest huge amounts of money in this wall.
You spoke about the Democrats. They've said that the wall itself is an expensive and impractical use of federal money. Have they offered any alternatives to the president when it comes to border security, for instance?
So they have. Earlier in negotiations, a couple days ago, actually, the Democrats did sort of float the offer of about $1.3 billion. Added to the funding bill in funding for border security more generally. So potentially that could be used for a wall, or it could be used for surveillance or other purposes, but it would be earmarked for border security. I think Democrats, probably rightfully considering their constituency, don't want to be seen as caving to what they see as an absurd idea. But because of pressure from the Republican Party's rather far-right flank, the president, who seemed to be entertaining that idea, gave it up, pushed back, and said that he would not be willing to accept anything but the full $5 billion. And so here we are.
Christine Emba is a columnist and editor for The Washington Post. We are talking about the government shutdown. As we heard earlier, the president said that the United States was having, quote, a little bit of a shutdown, end quote. Sounds like he's trying to downplay the impact so far. What have we already seen as a result of the shutdown 5 days in?
Well, we're beginning to see a bit of panic. I would say that, first of all, this is only a partial shutdown. So it's really non-essential government, federal government employees who will be furloughed or sort of out of work until the government kicks back into business. So Social Security, the Postal Service, veterans benefits, and obviously the military will keep working. But things like national parks, State Department services, environmental and food and drug inspections, those are the departments that may be shuttering for a few days in the near future. We're seeing a lot of federal contractors who are often low-income workers being put out of work because the businesses that they serve are closing. One of the most alarming things, though, that we're hearing is that, you know, there are some departments that may not be fully prepared for this shutdown who do depend on annual funding. Food stamps and food assistance for women and infants, that administration has said that they have some funding, but they will begin to run out of funding in the fairly near future. And that could have a huge effect for low-income people across the country.
Now, this can be a dangerous game of political chicken for both the Democrats and Republicans, and the president especially, if the shutdown lasts for a while. What do you think is going to take for one side, either Congress or the president, to yield somewhat on this issue?
Well, I think we may see a change after the new year, certainly, when Democrats gain a majority in the House. But I do think that we will have to see a lot more public outcry, I think, for the president to back down. At this point, it's sort of a pride thing. It's sort of a shoring up the base maneuver. We've already seen that, you know, last week the president said that he would take responsibility for the shutdown. It's on tape. It's very visible. So similarly, I think something very visible would have to happen for him to change his stance.
Now, the president has said that he would take responsibility for this. And the question then becomes, though, as this goes on, who's going to end up getting blamed for this? Will it be the president or will it be the Democrats, depending on how long this goes?
You know, it's hard to say. These shutdowns, don't really look good on anyone. But I do think that the president has, you know, clearly taken responsibility for this one. As I said, he said that on tape and in public in the White House last week. He is still tweeting frantically about this $5 billion, about this wall. He's now taken to saying that federal employees have apparently reached out to him and said that he should keep going, which seems like an obvious falsehood. It's unclear how that would happen and why they would do so. He really does seem on his back foot at this point, and I think that's because he knows that much of the reflection will fall on him.
We had a caller, and finally, I wanted to bring this up because the caller had an interesting point, and that was the fact that President Trump's campaign, part of his campaign promise, was not only the wall, but was also that Mexico would pay for the wall. Where is that now today?
That is not happening. I think that it's become clear as we've sort of watched the Trump administration and the president's statements continue over the past 2 years, that often statements are made, and when they don't pan out, we move on as if they never happened, or at least the president tries to. This seems to be one of those cases. You know, at the beginning, yes, the president was saying that Mexico would pay. Mexico said very bluntly, absolutely not. Now the president has tried to intimate that through this new trade agreement that he's settling, that there's somehow some change in that agreement that makes it so that Mexico is giving money for this wall. Mexico is not. That's just not happening. I think the president is trying to downplay and ignore what he said previously to try and, you know, keep what face he can.
To be continued. Thank you so much, Christine. We appreciate you coming on and spending a few minutes with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Christine Emba is a columnist and editor for The Washington Post. She was with us today to talk about the political fight that led to the government shutdown and the impact it's having on federal workers and others.
Coming up, why is it that so many people seem to have summer birthdays? We hear about the evolutionary science that's behind birth peaks for both humans and other creatures. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk to a film critic who will break down his picks for the best movies of 2018, and we'll ask for yours, too.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
When I was a kid, one of my favorite holiday songs was The 12 Days of Christmas. My brother and I would sing that song at the top of our lungs late into the night on Christmas Eve in anticipation of the gifts for us under the tree. But did you know that the first lyrics for the song were published in London in 1780? And that in the northern counties of England, the song was often called the 10 Days of Christmas, as there were only 10 gifts? And did you know that the 12 Days of Christmas has a Wisconsin connection? Meg Jones explains.
Whatever you think of the song, The 12 Days of Christmas, you can thank or blame a Milwaukee professor for bringing the holiday carol across the Atlantic Ocean. Emily Frances Brown was an English professor at Milwaukee Downer College. She organized and wrote annual Christmas productions at the all-women's school. While browsing in a bookstore in Oxford, England, she discovered the sheet music for a holiday song called The 12 Days of Christmas. She bought it, tucked it into her luggage, and brought it back to Milwaukee in 1910. That year, Brown's students first sang about partridges in pear trees, French hens, lords a-leaping, and five gold rings during the annual Christmas concert. They sang it the next year and the year after that. At some point, the song spread. Now, it's a bit of a stretch to say it went viral, but eventually it became part of America's collective holiday songbook. It wasn't unusual for European music to make its way to America via travelers such as Brown. Some came with immigrants who brought their instruments, choir books, and music traditions from their home countries, and some songs came as souvenirs picked up by music-loving tourists. The origin of the 12 Days of Christmas is uncertain, but many music scholars agree the melody is French and the lyrics probably came from 18th century England. Just why it caught on while other holiday songs did not is anyone's guess. The tune gets renewed attention each year when the annual estimate of the cost of each item in the song is released as a humorous economic indicator. The cost goes up and down depending on the economy, rising paychecks for dancers and drummers, a boost in the federal minimum wage for maids a-milking, and volatile swan prices. In recent years, the 12 Days of Christmas gifts totaled a whopping $34,000. But if you exclude purchasing swans, you'll only have to shell out around $23,000. Brown herself was a bit mystified by the song's popularity. She had no idea that a song celebrating excessive gift-giving would one day become so popular. In a 1957 letter to a former Downer student, she downplayed her part in bringing the infernal song to America. She wrote that she simply picked up a printed carol in the Oxford shop, brought it home to Wisconsin, and first used it at a dinner in Holton Hall in December 1910. The next year, it was used for a celebration of the 100th anniversary of Charles Dickinson's birth and repeated the following December. Brown taught at Milwaukee Downer College for 35 years until 1945. She died in 1958. The Downer College buildings are now part of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Downer College merged with Lawrence University in Appleton, where Brown's papers are archived. Among her memorabilia is that sheet music she bought on a jaunt to England more than a century ago.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author of World War II Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, much of our behavior is framed by the seasons, from when we're likely to plan vacations to when many of us are more likely to experience a little bit of depression. But our next guest sees something else that's influenced by the seasons, and that's human reproduction.
That's right. If you feel like you're sending out an awful lot of birthday cards from June to early November, you're not alone. And reproduction is seasonal across all living organisms, not just humans.
Michaela Martinez joins us now. She's an infectious disease ecologist and assistant professor at Columbia University in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences. She wrote the piece, "Tis the Season for Conception," for TheConversation.com. Michaela, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And first of all, great title. I use the term "tis the season" for lots of things. Don't think I've ever said for conception, but now I can check that off the list. Well, when did researchers first begin to notice birth seasonality in humans?
Yes, well, this phenomenon has been discussed in the literature for over 100 years, really. It wasn't until the last 80 or so years that biologists started paying attention to it. It used to be more of a focus of demographers.
And when we talk about birth seasonality, it's not just humans, and actually maybe it's much more obvious with, say, wildlife, because if you look at a phenology calendar, for instance, it'll often say this is the day that, you know, young muskrats will be emerging, things like that. It seems like the rest of nature is on a very seasonal calendar.
Yes, and actually, we can even see hints of this in our society. Here in the U.S., we have the Easter holiday. We oftentimes see pictures of young chicks and bunny rabbits, and that really comes from this association of springtime being the peak of the breeding season for a lot of birds and mammals in the Northern Hemisphere.
I'm guessing that as scientists do, when this pattern of human reproduction was noticed, the next question was, well, why? What's causing it? One of the theories is that there does tend to be a wedding season, which could have some influence over the birth peak, but you found a lot of other probably more convincing factors. What did you find might influence those peak times of human birth?
Yeah, so this is an argument that's been going on for many decades now among biologists and demographers, which is what drives birth seasonality in humans. Is it about behavior? So is it sexual intercourse? Or is it actually something to do with our physiology and our fertility? So wedding season would be a behavioral or societal factor. And it is the case that in some populations that the wedding season coincides with increase in births 9 to 15 months later, but that doesn't hold throughout the Northern Hemisphere where we've been conducting these studies.
And so instead of that, I think it's really interesting what you just said, and we kind of hopped over it, that this isn't just about when there might be intercourse that could lead to conception. There might be differences in fertility, which that might be affected by the seasons. What would the connection be there?
Absolutely. So if we look at wild mammals and birds, what we see is that they're not fertile year-round. For the most part, species that live outside of the tropics are only able to conceive at particular times of year. And so depending on what species it is, they will have hormonal cascades that essentially prime their body to be able to reproduce. And that usually occurs within a particular window of the year. If we think about deer in the Northern Hemisphere and in Wisconsin, you know, deer, the hunting season is in fall. That's when deer are in rut. That's when the females are able to get pregnant, and then they're pregnant all throughout the winter, and then they give birth in spring. For smaller mammals, they often have much shorter gestation periods, so they can get pregnant in the spring and then have their young that same season.
Now, you mentioned earlier something specific to the Northern Hemisphere. What difference is there between, say, people who are living close to the equator, where there is not nearly as much of a difference in the length of the day, for instance, versus those of us who may be much further north or south of that?
Yes, well, up until very recently, and actually until even to this day, there really hasn't been any published data in the scientific literature on birth seasonality in the Southern Hemisphere, only because of the the availability of data, essentially, not having birth records from Latin America and African countries. And in fact, earlier this year, I started working with some colleagues in Brazil and funded by the Brazilian government to look at human birth seasonality across Brazil, including in the Amazon. And what we find is, in fact, there is birth seasonality in the tropics, and even in Amazonian communities, but those data haven't been published yet.
We often, I think, forget how closely related we as humans are to the rest of the natural world. And as I was reading your article and talking with you, Michaela, part of me is surprised that we are as fertile as we are year-round as humans. Does that set us aside in some way from the rest of the animal kingdom?
It does in some ways. But humans, we evolved in the tropics. So when we think about where humans live today, we are dispersed globally, but that is not where our evolutionary ancestors were. And so we might be more similar in terms of our reproductive biology to tropical mammals who do have the capacity to breed year-round and reproduce year-round, but they don't necessarily fulfill that. And so there's a difference between having the capacity to and then having variation in fertility throughout the year. And so, yes, we are able to get pregnant at any time, but we might be more physiologically primed and more fertile at particular times of year. And that could be either male or female fertility.
Hmm. And Michaela, as we wrap up, as you said, researchers think that humans are starting to lose some of the birth seasonality, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. What might that mean for the future of human fertility and reproduction?
Well, birth rates overall are not necessarily declining. That depends on the country. But the seasonal cycle in births is definitely dampening out, and it seems to be disappearing. Now, whether that actually has an impact on our society, it still remains to be seen. This can be birth seasonality very likely is an evolutionary relic and may not be influencing us in our day-to-day lives very much. But my thought is that understanding whether or not there are seasonal cycles in fertility can perhaps help us in terms of planning pregnancy or for women who are having fertility challenges.
Well, Michaela, thanks so much for joining us. Michaela Martinez is an infectious disease ecologist and an assistant professor at Columbia University. She joined us to talk about seasonality of births.
Coming up, we'll talk with one of our favorite film critics who will share some of his favorite movies of the past year. I'm Darrell Conner.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up tomorrow after 7:45 on The Morning Show, host Kate Archer Kent and her guests talk about the difference between best-selling books and significant books. That's tomorrow morning at 7:45 here on the Ideas Network.
First, 2018 might be remembered as the year that big Hollywood movie studios started to listen to audiences and finally opened the door to featuring more non-white casts in mainstream films.
Black Panther became the top-grossing superhero film of all time in North America, and Crazy Rich Asians became the first mainstream U.S. movie in decades to feature a predominantly Asian-American cast.
And the same can be said for the wider diversity of themes represented in Hollywood movies this year. Director Steve McQueen's film Widows and Spike Lee's Black Klansman both earned high praise and were considered successes at the box office.
Joining us now to share some of his favorite movies of 2018 is Reggie Ponder, known as Reggie the Real Critic. He appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago and critiques movies for several other media outlets. You can follow him on Twitter at Reggie the Real Critic. Reggie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, hey, I'm really happy to be back. Judith, where you been, Judith?
I know. Well, you know, Rob's usually on. I let him have the week off. So nice to talk to you, and nice to introduce you to Darrell, because he's a big movie guy, Reggie.
I'm scared now.
Well, Reggie, let's start by digging into some of the 2018 Golden Globe nominees. What stands out to you in the best motion picture drama category?
What's actually interesting is that the diversity that you see here is that when you look at Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, If Beale Street Can Talk and A Star Is Born, those are the five in the drama, and that's as diverse as I've ever seen. The Golden Globes. I mean, wow! Kudos to them.
So you just mentioned Black Panther, and of course, it had massive success. What does that mean that this heavily African American cast, crew, and themes were so successful?
I think it means a number of things, but the first, the social impact of this film is actually not to be understated. Is what Coogler was able to do here, in taking a popular film but also making it have a social impact and social relevance, was absolutely phenomenal. And I think that it raised the level of superhero films in a way that they actually made these expectations that the next one, people were going to be like, okay, can you stay at that level and not just make these movies bang, bang, fight, shoot 'em up kind of films. What it says, I think, for Hollywood, if they pay attention, is that when you have these diverse films with diverse casts and you have a cross-section of people going to these movies, that this is a great way to appeal to different people, but also make money. And so if you want to make money, this is one of those ways in which to do so.
Well, and Reggie, I want to say that obviously a lot of attention, deserved attention, was focused on the fact that it was an African-American cast, but I was really also taken with the women characters in Black Panther. I thought they were amazing.
And they were. One of the things that I loved about this film is that point, Judith, is that the fact that this issue between from a cultural perspective, a fight between African American women and African American men as if they don't get along, here they actually show how powerful women and powerful men can coexist together and lead a nation. So phenomenal in that way. And wow, the women in this one were very pivotal to the entire film.
You know, Reggie, you were talking about the diversity with these films in this particular category, and overall with the success of Black Panther and the success of Crazy Rich Asians. For so long, we've been told that movies with a majority African American cast, or majority Asian cast, or majority Latino cast, don't do big in the box office either in the U.S. or even internationally. Does this now put all of that to rest with the success of these movies?
No, not quite. if you remember, there was a renaissance of film when you had Spike Lee, John Singleton,
right,
of the world. And I don't know if you want to call it a renaissance, but there was a boom during that time. And everybody felt during that time that, wow, this is going to be a great moment for diverse films. But one of the things that you don't see is that, yes, you saw African-Americans, yes, you saw Asians, but that was one Asian film. And from a Hispanic, Latino perspective, it's woefully inept, the diversity that we can see from a Latino perspective. So I wouldn't get too excited. I would just say that the trend seems to say that this could bode well, but there's a lot of work left to do.
We're talking with Reggie Ponder, also known as Reggie the Real Critic, and we are looking at some of the best 2018 movies, maybe some of the worst, too. Let's move on, Reggie, to nominees for the Golden Globes in musical or comedy category. What are some of the ones that really stood out for you?
So what's funny here is the same thing that I wanted to say. Look at this. Crazy Rich Asians, you have a period piece in The Favorite, you have a film that is controversial in many ways in Green Book. Then you have Mary Poppins Returns. And if I don't get another minute to talk to you guys about anything, all I want to do is just talk about Mary Poppins Returns. Oh, my goodness. But anyway, and then you have Vice, which is a totally different kind of movie. All five of these movies are very different, and all of them were really good, too.
Well, let's listen to a clip from Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins. Close your mouth, please, Michael. We are still not a codfish. Jane Banks. Still rather inclined to giggle, I see.
Good heavens. It really is you. You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? How incredibly rude. One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
You came back. I thought we'd never see you again.
It is wonderful to see you.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
So, Reggie, what did you love so much about Mary Poppins Returns?
There's a lot to like about this movie. I think the first thing is that when you look at the original Mary Poppins, it has that old nostalgic feel to it, a vaudeville feel to it. It's a musical. It's kind of whimsical. I found myself, Darrell, I've been on here with Judith Fork a number of times, so I don't think she heard me use these words like delightful, supercalifragilistic. I mean, this is one of those films. If you liked Mary Poppins, you're going to love Mary Poppins Returns. It is played the cast is fantastic. The music is poignant. I mean, there's a message in everything in it. And if you like Dick Van Dyke,
mm-hmm.
the movie in and of itself, just to go see him do the dance scene that he did, he actually did that scene too, and it's phenomenal. It is a great, great story here. And if you know about Mary Poppins, the story is that she comes back because she has to help the Banks family. And she has to remind the son how to believe in himself, about the magic in life, and she does that through his children. And it's fun. I mean, the animation looks good. The songs are phenomenal. Lin-Manuel Miranda is great. This is a great film all the way through.
I have just a quick question about Mary Poppins, and that is, when you heard this was going to be made, and it was called Mary Poppins Returns, did you have a concern or worry that, oh, here we go, we're going to dig back into a classic and we're going to somehow mess it up? Was that a concern of yours when you first heard this movie was coming out?
I did not like the fact that they were making a sequel to Mary Poppins. I was like, no, don't do it. Please don't do it. And, you know, they brought the old animators back. They went back to the song, not the same people, but the song format. And I think that what they really wanted to do is remain true to Mary Poppins, and they absolutely did that. You know, to your question, Darrell, a lot of times they remake or come back with another episode of a movie, and it's really not that good.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. We're talking with Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. Reggie the Real Critic, and he's been sharing with us some of his favorite movies from this past year.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite movies you saw in 2018? What are you kicking yourself that you didn't get to see when it was in theaters? And was there a movie or an acting performance that you think deserves to win an Oscar or a Golden Globe? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Darrell Conner. We're talking about our favorite movies of 2018 with Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. Reggie the Real Critic.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What was the best movie you saw in theaters this year? What do you think lived up to the hype, or what do you think didn't? Do you have any Golden Globe or Oscar predictions? And what are you looking forward to seeing that's in theaters now, maybe during the holiday season? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Reggie, I have to say The Favorite is one that you talked about. I just saw it yesterday. Here's a clip.
I'm ready for the Russian ambassador.
Who did your makeup?
We went for something dramatic. Do you like it?
You look like a badger.
Oh.
Are you going to cry?
Really?
No.
I will manage it. Go back to your rooms.
Thank you.
Did you just look at me? Did you? Look at me! Look at me! How dare you! Close your eyes!
So, Reggie, I saw that yesterday. We went to see it with a lot of other people. It was a pretty full theater. We had been anxiously waiting for it to come to Madison, and I have to say I was disappointed.
You were disappointed?
I was.
So I actually liked this. Not from an Oscar or a Golden Globe perspective that it was the best movie of the year. It was actually entertaining to me to watch these two women and their conniving ways in which to get the affections and the influence of the queen. Tell me, what was it about this one that didn't feel right for you?
Well, I think it's one of those things where when you really kind of build it up in your mind, I thought that, first of all, it's a true story, and they never actually say that. We went home and looked up the history, and it's very accurate, and I think actually that would have added to it, knowing that this wasn't just a story being told, but it was history being told. And I thought the three actresses were so powerful, and it didn't really make as good a use of them as it could.
Oh, okay. Well, see, and that's what I love about the movies, too, is that it really is taste. So when you go to these things and you say, what's the best movie of the year, I don't subscribe to that in terms of saying it's the best movie. It's the movie I like the best, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Reggie, you know, there's been plenty of superhero franchise movies released this year and over the past few years. In a recent review of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, you said that this movie addresses, quote, superhero fatigue. How does it do that?
So there are a lot of folks who are saying, I am just tired of the same old superhero movie. I think Black Panther helped to pull us out of that because it was so different
right. From
the messages and the layers that it had. But then you just come right back to Avengers, Infinity Wars, now you got Aquaman. I mean, you just come back to the same kind of stuff. And really, the stories are the same, is that, okay, somebody's coming to destroy the universe. Superhero comes to save the universe. Superhero almost dies, but superhero revives and then saves the universe. So some folks are like, I'm just tired of seeing all of that. And what Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse does is that it takes it to a whole different realm and eschews the intended pun. But you have all these different Spider-Men fighting Kingpin, Doc Ock, and crew, and it's the animation in this is fantastic. You get that Spidey humor that you're looking for. So it gives you a different movie and excites you again about superheroes, but it says, hey, this is a different type of fare for you.
We've got a cut from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Let's play that.
Spider-Man. I mean, this guy swings in once a day, zip-zap-zop in his little mask and answers to no one, right?
Yeah, Dad, yeah.
I love you, Miles.
Yeah, I know, Dad.
You gotta say I love you back.
Dad, are you serious?
I want to hear it.
You want to hear me say
I love you, Dad.
You're driving me off out of school?
I love you, Dad.
Look at this place.
Dad, I love you.
Dad, I love you.
That's a copy.
That is from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. You know, Reggie, what's interesting about this is, you know, not only yourself, but most of the critics absolutely love this, which is tough to do because how many incarnations of Spider-Man have we had over the last 15 years?
And that's why I say, Darrell, that this really cuts through. It's so different. And a friend of mine went to see it, and they didn't love it as much as I did, and might not like it as much as the critics liked it. But I think, again, if you try to dissect something like this, you'll say to yourself, well, it doesn't look or feel like any of the other movies that I've been seeing, and I think that the foundation of that is great. And then they have all the other stuff that you want to have in terms of humor and the fighting and the you know, the humor, the fighting, and the animation, it just all looks good. This is a good one, and it's very enjoyable. This is what I would say, Darrell, is that, hey, let me sneak and go see this, and I'm an adult kind of movie.
We're talking with Reggie Ponder, also known as Reggie the Real Critic. We're talking about 2018 movies, and let's go to the phones now, and Randy in Ripon is up. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I just want to say I agree with it. There's too many superhero movies. I'm really sick of that. But, of course, I tend to be more of a drama person. But I went to see Welcome to Marwen, and I was thoroughly pleased with it. Maybe it's partly because my dad was a World War II vet, and there was kind of that connection to it. But I thought it was just a great performance by Steve Carell. So thank you.
Thanks for that, Randy. And, Reggie, what did you think of Welcome to Marwen?
So again, this one is a different type of movie. Someone told me once is that I guess that there are only 8 stories in the universe. And so the real key is how do you tell that story to make it different and appealing to people? And I think Welcome to Marwen did that in a very interesting way. And it's one of those, it does tug at the heartstrings. So a good job.
So for those of us that haven't seen it, what's the plot in, 20 words?
What's the plot in 20 words? he's an outsider. He's basically an outsider. And in order to cope, he creates a whole different world. And you see that world in these figures that he creates. And these figures and people really come to life in that world.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Richie in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Richie, welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
So what did you like this year, Richie?
2018, for me, is the year of Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary on Mr. Rogers.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what did you like about it, Richie?
What I liked about it was in a society where everything's getting pushed at us and there's so much anxiety amongst kids and we're getting pulled in so many directions that this was a man, it sort of exposed a man that helped us learn how to connect better as people in a positive way. You know, so many documentaries dig up the dark underbelly, the Michael Moore stuff. I just left this movie. Now,
Reggie, sorry about that. We lost you. Richie, I'm sorry. Reggie, to Richie's point about the documentary, has there ever been a nicer dude than Mr. Rogers? I can't think of anybody nicer than Fred Rogers, ever.
So what's so interesting, there's been a number of pieces out there about Mr. Rogers, and I grew up on Mr. Rogers, so I actually want to sing the song, Who Are the People in Your Neighborhood? But I won't do that because I want to spare your readers. But when you talk about nice, he was also a visionary and an activist.
Mm-hmm.
So what you learn here is that this is the guy who did things like, okay, they won't allow this person on TV, I'll bring him on TV. Okay, something happened here, then I'll make a show about that to teach kids about tolerance and diversity and all of that type of stuff. So when you talk about a nicer man, that might be the least of his qualities. This guy was a righteous guy as well. So I love Mr. Rogers.
And Reggie, as we wrap up, we talked about 2018 being a real year of change in how Hollywood is making movies. Do you see that continuing into 2019?
I do, for the simple reason that I think that the women are being bolder and going out there to show the stories that they want to tell. I always have had a problem when there are men writers writing women's stories. I don't mean that we can't, but I want to see more women writing those stories and directing those stories. And what we're seeing in terms of women directing $100 million budgets has changed, not dramatically, but the trend is upwards. So really excited about that and in seeing that. What I hope to see, though, and I talked to a little earlier, is I'd like to see more Latino films. Not the directors are doing well, as you probably can see from the Oscars.
And we'll have to leave it there. Reggie Ponder, Reggie the Real Critic, was with us to talk about 2018 movies, the hits and the misses. You can follow him at Reggie the Real Critic on Twitter.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about the enduring appeal of actual vinyl records and LPs, and if there will always be a place for them in an increasingly digital world.
And weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 6:30, what were your favorite TV shows in 2018, and what are your hopes for 2019 viewing? Kate and her guests look at the most popular offerings this year and what themes emerged for TV watching. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30, right here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next is the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll look at presidential holiday traditions throughout American history. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.